We're talking about House to House, a soldier's memoir. Staff Sergeant David Bellavia wrote a very compelling book, and you'll feel like you're there. In fact, we'll explain just what it was like to go from house to house in Fallujah as they were searching for the counter. Well, they were searching for insurgents, but in particular, a particular type of insurgent. And we'll explain that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, talking about house to house, David Bellavia, I wanted to make the point that as you started in this this campaign to move from one side of Fallujah to the other and to flush out as many of the Mujahideen as you could, many of the of these particular insurgents, you were looking for a level of professionalism in these soldiers that I thought was very interesting, and that we might more casually think of people kind of, you know, grubby, taking a gun, firing it wildly. But you know better. You know that these guys were, these were not rank amateurs that you were up against in Fallujah.
No, these guys were. I mean, first of all, the thing that really kind of shocked me was just the area that these guys were coming from. I had long assumed that we were fighting, you know, again, I mean, you know, we're kind of like, you know, just incubated as far as where information is coming from. So, you know, you fight a guy on the street, you figure he's an Iraqi. We're starting to see Africans. We're starting to see Asians, you know, after firefights. Fallujah, you know, I call it the global all-star team of Islamic aggression. I mean, it literally had people from all over the world, Chechnya, the Philippines, you name it. They all came to one little area, and these guys were literally running with rockets and firing them at a level of expertise that these kids, they had to have been learning this, you know, at a school age. I mean, you know, I know enough about my craft and my profession to know what it takes. You take a green recruit and you teach him how to, you know, shoulder a weapon and you know, you're going to have to put some time into that young man to expect him to run and to do these things on the fly and a dead sprint. You know, I'm used to stalking the enemy. Never had had the enemy stalk me. That's humbling to see when you're seeing the enemy bound towards your position, when you have Marines, Navy, Air Force. I mean, Fallujah literally was my generation's Normandy Beach. I'm not saying it was at the level of Normandy Beach. I'm saying for my generation, there was never been a firefight, a battle, that had all the branches of service shoulder to shoulder. Fallujah was it. It was our Super Bowl.
But part of the two is, as a Super Bowl, you know, it's not the NFL versus the high school All-Stars. It's the two best teams in the NFL. And in this case, you've got these guys who were much more sophisticated in booby trapping the houses that you are going house to house with than you were anticipating.
It was unbelievable. There was one in particular. This guy took cinder blocks, and you know how at an airport they'll serpentine the traffic. Basically, they'll canal you in so that you can't speed up. They might put little jersey barriers, little concrete structures, and make you kind of drive left and right, snake you around to control the traffic. Well, this guy built basically a serpentined maze that was about 11 feet high of cinder blocks, and you basically followed the maze to the front door. And as you looked up out of the maze on the rooftop, he had two little machine gun nests so he could shoot down at you, and there were IEDs at the entrance and at the exit. I mean, it's like they're playing games. They knew that the American soldiers and Marines like to take rooftops out. And one of the things that we like to do is, you know, at Gettysburg, you had little round top and big round top. You know, wars have always been fought on elevation, high ground. In a city, your elevation and your high ground are the tops of buildings. So the key is to occupy that terrain, grab that top of the tallest building. And then as you're going building to building, you know, you don't want to just go through the door every time. You want to go rooftop down to the bottom floor, and then bottom floor to the rooftop, and mix it up so you kind of, you know, can surprise someone if you can. Well, these guys knew that we wanted to get to the rooftop, so they would literally seal every one of the doors that was facing a road, just makeshift mortar and brick. And then when we would jump rooftop to rooftop, they removed the roofs so that you literally jumped down multiple stories onto basically large metal rods and explosives. The most terrifying aspect of this invasion was the what we call the BCID, a building contained IED, improvised explosive device. It's a house bomb, a building bomb. You walk in, they have C4 explosives all over the stress bearing walls. They, you know, basically have gasoline and a concussion. And in one case, they had a MiG-23, a Russian jet. It's a drop tank in the middle of a house, in the middle of the room. When you walk in and you see that, it's like that. I don't know if you ever had that nightmare where you're in a road and a car's coming and your legs are like concrete.
Right.
You see that and you're like, you know what? Man, I could have been a Green Beret. I could have been the, you know, Captain America, Spider-Man, any superhero is going to die in this house. It doesn't matter who you are, what you've done. Your life is over if anyone steps on a wire, leans on the wall. You know, it literally is. It got to the point where I had to tell my soldiers to stop looking for booby traps because we were so concerned that we were going to trip a wire or, you know, trigger something that we stopped hunting the guys that we're trying to kill. So I can't have a bunch of 19-year-old kids looking for a wire when they're supposed to run through a door and shoot whoever's waiting for us.
But at the same time, it was important for you to know, too, as you talk about that sense that these guys that you were trying to find were way ahead of you. They knew where you were going to be. They knew what you were going to be experiencing. They were controlling your experience in Fallujah up to a point.
I would say up to probably the second week, absolutely. The one thing, the one aspect that really was, to me, psychologically debilitating to the soldiers that I was leading, you know, just to give a quick background, Fallujah is a city about the size of Tampa Bay, Florida. The entire population was in place when an April offensive of 2004 was stalled by the White House. Command didn't want, you know, civilian population to be killed. The civilian population left, and they basically, the administration had put in what was called a Fallujah Brigade. They gave them uniforms, equipment, and all of our stuff that we use to protect us, our force protection, bomb blast walls, and big bins that keep, you know, bullets from entering walls and all that great stuff. And they gave it to the Fallujah Brigade and said, look, you want the Americans out? We're out. You guys take care of yourself. Well, they became the enemy. And so now we're basically fighting against not only our own equipment, but our own uniforms. And so we, you know, had these kids that were like, you know, I'd have a soldier and he'd tell me, hey, put your chin strap on. And he'd be like, why? And I'm like, well, because, you know, that chin strap is going to save your life. Put your uniform on. You know, every single time that these guys wanted to take their stuff off because they were hot, I would have to be like a father and tell them, no, put that back on. You're going to wear that. It's going to save your life. And now our enemy's wearing that. So let me show you exactly where to shoot on the helmet to, you know, neutralize it so you can kill the guy who's wearing the same helmet that you're wearing. And so the soldier would be like, wait a minute. If you know how to do that to our equipment, why can't they do it to ours? You know what I mean? Like, right. All this time you've been telling me our equipment's the best in the world. Now we're going to fight against guys who look like us and dress like us. Yeah. They were wearing our uniform. They had our equipment. Everything that we went to bed and had confidence that we would wake up in the morning, the enemy had it too. And that's really tough for me. It was tough for me. And I'm sure it was tough for my soldiers as well. My God, you know, there were times we would, shoot guys in the street, and I would have to count everyone.
To make sure that you hadn't shot any of your own guys?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're wearing our helmets and our boots, and it was just always a head count. Like, oh, my God, you know, like, who got behind us?
Right.
I wanted to focus on the fight, and I had to focus on all these other elements that were kind of swarming around us. It just wasn't supposed to happen like that. You never plan for it.
Yeah, we have an understanding, I think most people in America do, based on what we've experienced in the media, of what it is like to be away from home and to be away from the holidays. And there's a lot of stories, you know, that we still experience about what it's like to recover from injuries. But I think there is a gap in our knowledge that the book House to House really helps to explain. And that's one of the pieces of that, because that would be like in World War II, it would be like us showing, you know, invading in Normandy and having all the Germans wearing our uniforms. You wouldn't, I mean, that can't happen very often in the history of American warfare, that we're fighting against people that we gave, who has our up-to-date technology to use against us.
Yeah, I mean, you hope not. I mean, and God, you know, forbid if it happened again. There's so much to worry about. I knew when the first bomb started to fall, you know, I knew that we weren't going to have sleep for a while. I knew that we weren't, you know, going to have access to food or water, but I could not help. I had to take it all in because I knew that at some point when my grandchildren, if I was to make it out of here, my grandchildren were like, you know, what is combat like? What is war like? I had no idea. Every battle in Iraq was different, but Fallujah to me was the closest thing I could get to really saying, you know, this is about as hellish as it could possibly be. When you are on every fight that I was ever in, you would shoot a guy, he'd die, and then someone would, you know, like central casting would come in and just take the body away, or our guys would come and just take the body away. In Fallujah, if you died, you died, and you stood there. And those guys that died in April were still on the ground.
How far along? They died in April, and they were still there for how long?
Oh, this was November. I mean, we're talking bodies that were, you know, I mean, tortured. There were torture houses that were just obviously skeletons of people that, you know, Al-Qaeda torture houses. But, you know, I found God, I can't even count how many bodies we would find that were just, you know, mossed and molded over with a weapon in their hands. I don't, you know, I'm not Dr. Baden, but I could
right.
surmise Quincy would tell me that it was definitely a couple months before I got there, you know.
Right.
But the smells and honestly, it's just a giant bin, just a giant bag of bacteria. And, you know, after 2 or 3 days of being rained on and cold and running and, you know, that now the sore throats kick in and then the fevers hit and your hands are dirty and you're trying to find food and you're eating the filth and you're sleeping and it hits you all at once and you're tired and you're hungry and you have a sore throat and a temperature and you're like, you know what? I read about this during the Panama Canal. You know what I mean?
Right.
I read about this during the Battle of the Bulge. I never thought that we would go through anything similar to this.
Because we thought our technology would save us from that kind of physical depravity.
Exactly. And the other thing is that, you know, when we talk about, you know, whatever, you don't have to get shot to know that when you hear an explosion, you know, I think anyone that lives in the 21st century knows that, you know, we all have a spidey sense of what danger is. You hear tires lock up, get away from the road. You don't need to be hit by a car to know what that's like. And bullets are the same way. You know, you hear a round go over your head and, you know, just by instinct, you're going to recoil and get down and get away from that. But we're not expecting our injuries out of a combat zone to be bite marks or having your hair pulled or seeing the enemy. We went an entire year and I could count probably on, you know, 12 occasions that we actually were in like a close quarter fight And that close quarter fight might have been, you know, in a house, they might be two rooms away, which is, don't get me wrong, absurd to fight in a house that someone's two rooms away, but not where they're coming through the door that you're in. You know, not like, you know, I could only compare it to like the Imperial Japanese when I'm watching, you know, the Pacific, or I'm watching a movie where these guys, sure, you're shooting them as they almost run into you. It's, it, you know, and then to add all of that, you know, all of the stress and all the things you have to combat, these guys are doing drugs.
Well, and I think that drug part was really interesting. They're doing drugs that we developed.
And, right? You know, thank God they don't get the New England Journal of Medicine, because they're not really, they're not too smart about the way they're using the drugs. But they use epinephrine and atropine. Basically, they got a hold of our nuclear biological chemical kit. And the atropine would, you know, basically keep the epinephrine keeps the heart beating if you were in some sort of a chemical attack. And, you know, so you've got one thing that you hit, it's just going to keep your heart beating, you know. And unfortunately, when you're bleeding, that's going to make you bleed all the more faster. But there is a moment when you mix that with an opiate, which these guys were tying off their arms, and, you know, you'd find the spoon and the residue and the needles. A lot of times, you know, we would shoot someone and you'd go to lift them up just to get them out of the way, and they'd have a snapped off needle in their arm. And so now you're like, hey, you know, I never thought I'd have to worry about a pinprick. You know what I mean? Like, you call a medic for that. You know what I mean? Like,
right. But even I don't want to miss, for people who haven't caught on to this, part of what you're saying is that with the epinephrine and the painkillers, with the opiates, that they would be charging you with a weapon, and they would keep discharging a weapon long past when the average person would have died. I mean, it's almost like they're given, to go back to the video game comparison, it's almost like they're given extra life, and yeah, they're still squeezing a weapon off when they should have died.
And you know, there's an example in the book, you know, that, you know, these machine guns, you know, if they're on a stable platform, they're very accurate. And a machine gun is basically like a lasso. You move the machine gun and the rounds are going to do what a whip does. You know, it responds maybe half a second from the source. If you move left and right, it's like, you know, bringing, sure, a whip left and right. That's what the bullets do. And if you saw, you know, at knee level, you know, a person should stop running. You know, if 500 rounds are hitting them at the knee level, and, you know, they not only did they keep coming, it took multiple magazines to drop a guy. I mean, you know, you're thinking, we're going to have to recalibrate our weapons because we're just off, we're missing. And then you look in the ground and you're like, you're spot on. I mean, there's no way a person.
It's like a zombie.
Yeah, it really is.
It was like being attacked by zombies.
Yeah, the only way to really stop them was to hit them in areas of the anatomy that, you know, that was bone. You had to, you know, you had to get them to the point where they were down and drop them. But at the same time, it, you know, this, every one of these things, you talk about energy, you know, if your bar is at 100%, every time you experience this stuff, you're going backwards. It's just, there's only so much you could take, you know, and now you're sick and you're scared and you're running around, and these guys are just, their lives mean nothing. It's, it's tough.
Well, and so coming back on this subject, I want to contrast that experience of what you're talking about, these low points, like, you know, whether it's when you're in that trench, that sewer trough that you had to walk through, or whether it's when you're in the midst of the Fallujah fight. I want to talk about the comparison between when you really start to get an idea of what this ring of hell is like. How do you process that? As a soldier, how do you keep, you know, yourself from putting the gun in your own mouth, or shooting yourself in your own foot in order to get out of it, like they did so often in Vietnam? We'll talk about that coming up on Coast to Coast. Also, we'll ask about the role of the chaplain, who plays an important part of the story, house to house, as you begin to understand what they also had to decide not to think about. next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So we're talking about House to House. This is a very popular book. Staff Sergeant David Bellavia, home now from Iraq, home from his service, but never far from his thoughts are the people that are still there and the soldiers with whom he served. And he tells their story beautifully in this book and will explain, too, just exactly how they get through it. There's lots of discussions about this in the book on the kind of the soldier's bravado versus those inner demons that nag away, even in the midst of a fight. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. David Bellavia, author of House to House. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. And also while you're there, take a look at the WikiLeaks story we were talking about earlier. Now, it kind of brings us, we sort of circle back to where the conversation started in this way. You know, there's a lot of pressures on the soldier, a lot of things that they have to try to be perfect, try to get it right, try to make these, you know, these snap second decisions to get the most effective use out of both their own talents, but also to save the person next to them, to try to minimize the enemy. There's a lot going on. So how do you process having killed somebody and then finding out later on that they may not have been as lethal as you might have thought, or to have collateral damage in the form of civilians that were not part of the fight that die in the process? How do you start to work through that?
Well, first of all, Fallujah was not that case because, you know, civilians were gone and everyone sure. in that town, you know, they all had weapons and that wasn't a problem. But before that, it's one of those things that you, you know, I was a husband and a father, and, you know, there are little boys that are your kids' age and everything registers. It's really, there's no suspension of disbelief to imagine you in their shoes. At the end of the day, though, you just have to completely compartmentalize everything. Everything that you experience in that combat zone. I made a call in my own heart when I left for war, and it's so funny because I talk to veterans from other generations, and they tell me the exact same thing. It's like an unspoken little, you know, compact that you make with yourself, and it's you are already dead the day you step on that plane. Everything is already in order. You're prepared to die that day. Every day you wake up is a gift, and you're prepared at night that you're going to meet your maker. You're gone. And when you can put all of that into kind of a big old bottle and just cork it, all of it will come out at the end. And unfortunately, it'll manifest itself in the craziest spots. I mean, you might be at a soccer game, and bam, you're right back to where you were, and you think about all those horrible things. It's so crucial. One of the things that I've been trying to do is it's just so crucial for veterans to be able to talk to each other and to work these things out. But in the moment when you're, you know, standing over, you know, someone or that you don't exactly know, you just have to say, you know what, look, I'm in a combat zone and this kid had a weapon and I'm alive and he isn't. And that's the way this is the way the game's played.
You know, I'll take that. Let me push it back a little bit then to the story that we started with talking about, the one that's been very much discussed on CNN and Fox News and on the internet. And if you go online to coasttocoastam.com, it'll link you to the story. Is that, you know, here you've got a case where you've got some journalists who may have had cameras over their shoulder, may have had the strap of a shoulder of a camera, you know, instead of an AK-47. And that gets by some people, they look at that and go, oh, well, see, he's got a weapon. But if you can't tell, well, you don't have to ever feel bad because it's war. And I think that there are sometimes when I see some of the posts, and I've been reading a lot of blogging about this, is that there's so much of this bravado about, well, that's what the guy gets for standing next to somebody who has a gun. Or, you know, I can't be held responsible for that because, you know, he picked the wrong country to try and shoot pictures in. whatever that it seems like, well, as I read them, a lot of them seem like just total overstatements to try to cover up for the basic fact that an innocent guy was killed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'm referring to a section of my book where there was a young boy, you know, teenager, that had a weapon that was pointed in my direction. And honestly, I don't know if he was protecting me from something. And that happened a lot out there, Ian. You'd get in a firefight and you'd see an old woman pull out a AK-47 and start shooting other bad guys.
Right.
And you're like, listen, stop. I got this. You know, you didn't know who was on your side or who was trying to kill you.
Right.
So I didn't know if this kid was trying to shoot me or trying to shoot someone else. And, you know, I made the call and I dropped him. Now, you're talking about, you know, we're talking about a person 50 meters away that I could see and I can identify and I could take the target out. We're talking about a helicopter that could be a kilometer out of the way on a zoom lens. You know, one of the things that's, you know, 18 people can watch that video in 18 different, you know, I see this, I see that, there's Elvis, you know, who knows?
Right, right.
But you are absolutely correct. There are people that are strictly going to defend, you know, this is what we do and this is our thing. At the end of the day, though, if we don't have our ethos, if we don't have the ability to say, look, you know, life sucks and things happen. If I have to emote every day that a friend dies, this isn't just something that the bravado isn't just with innocent civilians. We're talking about our friends' brains being ripped apart.
Sure.
We don't have the luxury to sit back and say, my God, I want to just turn on, open a bottle and play some music and go through this. We can't do that. So I don't want you to just mistake this as saying, oh, it's just life and death and kids and innocents and civilians. This is across the board. This is our best friend. These are the people that stood at our weddings. We're not putting them in body bags. We're putting them in sandbags. They're gone. There's nothing to put in that casket but a boot.
Sure.
We're still not crying and we're still, you know, smoking a cigarette and saying, what are you going to do? You know, tomorrow's right. A new day. It's the only way to condition yourself so that you're not an emotional, you know, basket case. Now, I don't expect people to understand that.
No.
What I do expect is people not to, because what I fear is going to happen is that when these kids get back to society and they start to see the resume of being in a combat zone for three tours, this video is going to come into an employer's head. This is my fear. My fear is that video is going to play.
But stop right there. I think there's a difference. And I think you crystallize something right there. The difference between in reading House to House and knowing that you had to find a way to arrest your emotional development until you could get through that experience. You didn't have the luxury of stopping and singing Kumbaya and sitting in a circle and doing all of that. I totally get that. The difference is so many of the comments that are being made about this photographer, for example, who has a camera strap over his shoulder, and all of the cavalier comments are being made by people who are back. And so there's that twist again, which I think everybody could relate to what you're saying in the moment, in the time of it. But at what time, when is it appropriate for soldiers who come back to continue to talk about innocent death and to keep writing it off in this sort of overly joking manner, like, you know, tough luck, you know, so what, buddy? And not to sound like they totally lost their soul.
Well, this is what's so obviously this is why this story is so popular, is because there's so many different avenues that you could take this. I think you're onto something that, you know, is definitely, I would say, in the 90 percentile of what people are talking about. But to defend what these guys are saying, these comments, I think, you know, and again, I'm not of that mindset personally, so please don't think that's what I'm saying. But I think what this is all about is that we talked about the mistrust of the media. A lot of these guys don't know what, you know, why in the world would you want to walk around with someone that was trying to kill me? Why? What is it about the story? And I used to go through the same thing. Ian, I went back as an embedded reporter to Iraq after I served, and I would talk to these reporters in the tent. The soldiers hated us. it didn't matter if I used to be a soldier or not. They'd be like, you're in the media. I don't want to talk to you. And so we would just talk to each other. The only way the journalists could get the other side, if they chose to, was to go with the enemy. And what these soldiers would say to us is, how can you do that to me? I'm the one that's protecting you. If you get shot, I'm the one that's going to get you out of here. I feed you. I take care of you. You in bed with us. Now, how are you going to then tell us to get lost and go on the other side of the battlefield and then videotape my friend getting blown up? This mindset, and quite frankly, it's is it unfair? Is it warranted? I don't know. But they do not trust these guys that hang out with the enemy.
Right.
And
nope.
Unfortunately, with that ballistic that was used, the 30 millimeter, hey, I mean, anything that's near the target is going to get taken out. Now, the only thing, and again, I wasn't there. I don't really know if, you know, there was someone plant an RPG. I don't even know if what I'm listening to is the actual radio transmission. You know what I'm saying? I have no way to know what's going on. But what I do know is that, you know, if these guys were intentionally trying to kill civilians, they're a horrible shot because, I mean, there was other people that they could have lit up. They did not. I think that the thing that I think every veteran, when I heard the video and I heard the talking and the go get them, we all cringed. I cringed. I turned red, and I didn't. It wasn't that I was embarrassed. I just knew how my mother would act if she heard me saying those things.
Right.
Because I think we've all said them, but I just don't think that you want people to know that side of you. And I was thinking, oh my God, this poor guy is going to have to live with this because now everyone's going to think he's some kind of barbarian. That is the hardest part of combat, is to put that guy away, the animal that killed people and you know, stood over the remains of husks of people, and to come home and be a soccer coach to your kids.
Right.
You know, that's the hardest part. And if to me, that's kind of the majesty of mastering everything that it is to be a complete person, because back in the World War II days, we don't know who, you know, these guys just came home and you know, we didn't even know about PTSD. We
right.
just know that Patton slapped a guy in the face with a glove. You know, we
right.
don't know what that kid went through. And today it's kind of like, it seems to me just by being home that, you know, I've had people since the book has come out, hey, I don't feel comfortable with you around my children. And I look
at them.
Have
you had somebody say that to you before?
Oh, absolutely. I've had parents not want, you know, me to coach their kids because of language or because of,
right.
It happens, but it happens. And you can't control
right.
everyone. It's not, you know, par for the course. But at the same time, everyone's sensitivities are different. And when you see that video, you're going to have a completely different take on it than an Iraqi citizen, quite frankly, would. I could tell you right now, that videotape is it's a bad day that got out, because, you know, we're talking about this instead of talking about things that actually, quite frankly, I think are going to move the debate a lot farther.
To think we're talking about both. So in that sense, I think that part of what we're doing is talking about both the good part about what you experienced and the success of it, but also talking about the real life, you know, cold hard steel complexity of this type of warfare, and the fact that the helicopter was firing these rounds that you described earlier from a kilometer away, and at the same time making judgments about, making assumptions about what was going on the ground. It's a kilometer away. We don't know whether the journalist was, whether there was a guy saying, and if you don't take these pictures like I'm telling you to take these pictures, we'll shoot you. Or, you know, we don't know what was being said. We don't know what happened. We just know that everybody got lit up and everybody died. And the way that these guys talk about it, it sure sounds wrong. It doesn't, it's not a, I mean, to me anyway, and I understand you have a different perspective on it, and people can go again to our website at coasttocoastam.com and click onto it. I think it's fair to say that WikiLeaks has a very slanted view of how we should be looking at it. But you still, even if you peel away their editorial content on that, there's still something about it that, as you said and I said, you just go, you just cringe and just go, gosh darn it.
But you know,
that's not what this should be.
I don't don't mean to say this to be devil's advocate. Please understand what I'm
saying.
Go ahead. But there's an aspect, when I hear you say that, there's an aspect of me that really feels proud that you are shocked and horrified by that, because that means that you have never seen it before. And I think at our essence, what we do as warriors or as people who serve their country is to kind of insulate our population from those horrors. And when a normal, rational civilian who, you know, if we failed in our job, then, you know, you would be used to seeing people blown apart. And, you know, my job is to make sure that stuff never gets to your doorstep. And I think when I hear people, when I hear people talk about, you know, oh my God, I can't believe that, you know, the callousness, the deer is just on the road and they're freaking out about roadkill and all this other stuff. I think to my head, you know what? That's beautiful. I don't ever want anything more horrific to happen in your life than to see that dead possum on the road.
You gotta work with me on that. I think that's a really good point, but I don't want to get too far off your other point, because I fear like that sounds really patronizing to me. And there's a certain amount of, and David, I hope you have enjoyed this conversation enough to give me some elbow room on this, that sometimes when I read the accounts of soldiers as they're talking about this particular videotape, or even in some of the things that you wrote in House to House, there's a certain amount of experiential snobbery, that there somehow the experiences of war are elevated to the point where they are the defining experiences of life. And if you haven't had them, you are not as defined as a person as a soldier is. You know what I mean?
You know what? I'm telling you, in these 2 hours, you have brought up things, and this is, you know, the book was written in 2007. You are 100% correct on exactly touching on what is different between us and them. Why the war? There is a class in this country, you know, they serve the country. The chip on our shoulder when we go to a door, you don't have a bachelor's degree, you're not trained, right. You're not this, you're not that. And so we have to say, you know what? We've been through, we feel that our experience has entitled us to have our own class, and that we could say at the end of the day, hey, look, you don't want to do this job. It doesn't mean you're a coward, it doesn't mean you don't love our country. We chose to do this. You bet your ass we're going to be patronizing. I mean, that I'm just telling you.
I get that.
We're telling you, listen, if you don't want to do this, great. But here's the thing. Here's the deal. Here's a little handshake we'll make in our little smoky cigar room. Don't get in my business. If you want to stay in your lane, if you're speaking for the country, as an American, I'm offended that I'm seeing this on TV. That's your right. You have every right to be against the war. You have every right to do anything that an American can do. That is your inherent right as a citizen of this nation. But at the same time, we have to be careful of the judgments that we make in almost the same snooty, snarky tone.
Okay, but separately, again, I think you're making great points. And I know that when you say you mean the universal you, not me. Because,
Of course.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No, that's okay. I just don't want anybody to misinterpret that. And here's the irony. It's the army that wanted to keep that from being shown on television. I think there's a lot of people who can't quite relate to what people are going through. That videotape it's only one slice of the story, but I think that this is what we need, are 1,000 versions of that, not one. We need many, many more versions of what soldiers are experiencing, to hear the audio, to see what they see, in order for us to understand it. And in some ways, this conflict between this warrior class, as you describe it, and the people who haven't experienced it, it's a direct result of the Army's attempt to try to manage the perception of the war. And I want you to respond to that, but I'm just going to take this up to the top of the hour, and then we'll come back and we'll get all the calls. And I know that everybody will be lining up with you, David, so don't worry. You're going to have lots of reinforcements coming up. I'm just saying one part of my piece here. The book is House to House, A Soldier's Memoir, David Bellavia. And remember, tomorrow night, Vows of Silence. How far up the chain of command of the Vatican does the priest story go on Coast to Coast?